couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the films Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, Peter Pan and Wendy, Clock, The Black Demon, and Ghosted. I'm also going to be talking about the news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring a look back at Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Let's look at the box office from last week, and Super Mario Brothers movie is still going strong. Actually had a very impressive third weekend. It only dropped 35%, and it had almost $60 million. Now, to put that in perspective, that's more than Shazam Fury of the Gods has made at all. So this thing is a juggernaut, and right now, it's almost $900 million going into this weekend. This thing's going to be in the billion-dollar club soon enough. Multi-generational is what is key here in a lot of these things. You got to have to hit, it's not just four quadrants, you got to hit like eight quadrants. But then in second place, not to be outdone, was Evil Dead Rise, which made almost $25 million. And that's really impressive, especially considering they wanted this to go originally just to streaming. They were going to make this a Max movie, an HBO Max movie. More on that in a second. But Evil Dead Rise doing well in rebooting the Evil Dead franchise. We're going to get more. Then they had The Covenant, or Guy Ritchie's The Covenant. That's that war film. And that was a huge drop down to about $6.5 million from number two, which was Evil Dead's almost $25 million. And then the top five's rounded out with John Wick and Dungeons and Dragons. Right there in kind of a photo finish. I mean, John Wick's doing great. Dungeons and Dragons, I think we're still deciding whether that's good enough to warrant a sequel, because it's going to limp its way maybe close to, if not over, $100 million, but it's doing a little bit better overseas. But speaking of HBO Max and movies that were supposed to go directly to HBO Max, at CinemaCon this week, if you don't know what CinemaCon, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a convention about cinema, but it brings in a lot of the studios. They show new footage, they talk about their new projects, and it goes to a lot of, it's less of a public convention and much more of an industry convention. David Zaslav, who runs Warner Brothers now, he was talking about the slate of DC movies and Warner Brothers movies, and they've had a couple, feathers in their cap recently, especially with the, coming off the production of Evil Dead, which is a Warner Brothers movie. And that was good for them this week. They seem to forget that Shazam completely bottomed out earlier this year. But they're talking about going ahead, and they've got the Flash movie, and they did the first screenings of the Flash. But Zaslav said in his speech, he basically said, look, we're going to dive right into theatricals. And essentially said, we're not making movies for streaming. Which is a roundabout way of saying, any of those direct to HBO Max movies or Max movies, that's no longer going to be part of their business model. Now, I don't know how long it's going to take for them to get stuff out of the pipeline, because there are actual direct to HBO Max movies coming in the next couple months, but they're going to be backing off of those. This is all Warner Brothers' plan to try to beef up its streaming service, and I've been very critical of it, because it sounds to me like what they're doing is they have a relatively successful streaming service, and they're saying, we have too much stuff on there, and we want people to pay more for it, so we're going to start pulling content off of HBO Max and rolling in Discovery Plus, which, honestly, HBO Max and Discovery Plus couldn't be any different in their content. So it seems weird to try to merge them. And I think they're hoping that they're going to double their subscription rates, which I actually think that's going to be a big failure. But the reality is, it's not just about theatrical. You have to have both. Disney's doing it right. And Disney's kind of being pretty quiet about their strategy for this. I think what happened was Warner Brothers went all in for day and date streaming movies in 2021. And a lot of them didn't do well. You had a couple ones that did well, like Godzilla vs. Kong. That did pretty well, especially for being released during a pandemic. And then you had stuff like Dune did quite well. But like the big ones they were expecting, like In the Heights and Conjuring and Wonder Woman 1984 and even The Matrix, some of these movies did not do well. But I don't think they would have done well in a traditional theatrical release either. Maybe they would have had a bigger opening weekend. But putting them on Max was not what killed these movies. They just had a slate that wasn't a wide open slate for massive 4 or 8 quadrant appeal. And by doubling down on theatrical and basically shirking a streaming service you've literally spent years building seems very short-sighted in today's marketplace. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first trailer I want to talk about, it doesn't give you a whole lot of information, but it's worth mentioning, and that is Black Mirror Season 6 is coming to Netflix in June.
Let me show you how this will play out. 3, 2, 1.
You know none of this is right.
I love this.
Yowza.
I love it.
Oh, do you?
It's all anyone can talk about.
Now, one of the things, it's an anthology series, so anytime you get these anthology trailers, there's no sense of any plot. It's if you don't know what Black Mirror is, it's basically a very dark and depressing version of The Twilight Zone. It's an anthology series with these usually sci-fi or fantastical elements to it, where it tells an individual story. It's a fantastic series. It's dark and heavy, and it's very intriguing. It's a British show, but recently with a popularity, it's branched much out of just sort of that British mindset. The first season is very British as they move on. And that's the only thing that worries me is Black Mirror has become so popular that when you look at this trailer, there's a lot of famous people in here and that you're just like, I hope they didn't trade off the quality of the scripts for the gravitas with the guest stars. But I have faith in Black Mirror. I'm very much looking forward to what they've got showing up in the future. Hopefully it's a longer season than just like 3 episodes. The other one I want to talk about is Wish, which is a new animated Disney film coming to theaters on November 22nd.
Imagine a place where wishes come true. Where your heart's desire can become a reality. What if I told you that place is within reach? All you have to do is give your wish to me.
This is just a teaser, so we don't have too much about the regular play in the movie. And they do have a bit with the main character where this girl is, you know, I guess infiltrating, or she sort of disrupts the wish center. Most of that's the narration by Chris Pine, who plays kind of the bad guy. And this is done by the branch of Disney that did like Frozen and Moana. And it reminds me a bit of Frozen in the sense that it does take those, what would be an archetype good guy, and they give him the bad faith elements, because you kind of had that with the prince or the would-be prince in Frozen. You also had that a little farther back with the character of Gaston in the Beauty and the Beast movie. He was a really good-looking guy, which is normally Prince Charming, but he was essentially the bad guy. And so they're playing around with that. So I don't know. We'll see. I don't know much about this. The animation looks really well done, though. I like the style of animation, which is, it's 3D CGI animation, but it looks like it's a 3D rendering of 2D art, of cell animation. And I love that Disney will continually go back and embrace its original animated roots. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, we're going to take a look at Ghosted and Clock. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about one. It is actually from last week, Ghosted. And there's a reason why I didn't cover it last week, and it's just simply I was too busy. But this is worth talking about for a couple reasons, and we'll get to that in a second. A needy farmer falls for a girl who ghosts him, only to discover she is an international spy.
Any word?
She ghosted him.
I bet she isn't even seeing your text.
She does travel a lot for work.
Go to her.
I'm going to London.
Oh, God. You have the wrong guy?
I'm a farmer.
Wait.
Oh, whoa.
Who are you?
CIA.
So confused. They kept asking me about the taxman.
They asked you about the taxman?
They think I am a taxman. You're the taxman.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
There's a lot of people that are upset about this movie before this even came out. And one of the reasons they're upset is because it's an Apple TV Plus movie that never went to theaters. And there's a contingency out there, especially like if you go into film Twitter, there's a contingency out there who is very, very upset at anything that bucks that theatrical window. They rail on Netflix and they rail on places like Amazon or Apple. And apparently Apple's kind of pushed more of a commitment to some theatrical releases. But a movie like this, they're just dropping it right onto their streaming service. And I think the thing that upset people about it is it's a big action movie, rom-com action. It's sort of like The Lost City or Shotgun Wedding was the same kind of thing. That's the timber they're going for with this movie. Not only is it that which would be a theatrical movie, you know, something with action you'd expect to see in the theaters. It also stars Chris Evans and Ana de Armas, and she's really on her way up. So there's a lot of people who are angry that this movie that really feels like it should be a theatrical film went straight to streaming. Also, you got to remember, most critics just traditionally do not like romantic comedies. I'm not talking about there's no romantic comedies that they like, but in general, critics don't like a rom-com, and this is essentially an action-oriented rom-com. But you go back and historically look at very popular romantic comedies, and they generally do not have a good Rotten Tomatoes score. And so the fact that this thing got raked over the coals by the critics shouldn't be a big surprise or a big deterrent, because this is not a movie made for critics. Anyways, this critic actually thought it was fine. It's not great, but it's fine. I mean, it's your basic romantic comedy setup that has their meet cute where they meet in a farmer's market, go out on a date, and then spins into this international intrigue thing because she ghosts him and then he tracks her down in London and then he gets kind of wrapped up in the mission that she's involved in. And, you know, it's got normal, crazy international spy stuff, big car chase and stuff. And when it comes to the action is actually really good. I mean, the action is not at the level of like more recent James Bond film, but it's striving to be that for sure. And it has some really great action set pieces to it that look fantastic. The cinematography for it, especially in the action-oriented sequences, is actually quite good. I mean, it's impressive even. But as a romantic comedy, it's fine. I mean, I don't think that Chris Evans and Ana de Armas have the best chemistry, but they have some chemistry. I mean, heck, they worked together on Knives Out initially. That's they shared the screen in that. But the characters are somewhat two-dimensional, but that's kind of the name of the game in terms of a romantic comedy. The other thing that's interesting about that I kind of picked up on is this sort of flips the gender roles, not in an aggressive way, but usually a movie like this, you'd have something like Romancing the Stone from 1984, where Michael Douglas lives in the jungle and knows how to fight and he has got a gun. And then Kathleen Turner played this fish out of water romance author who's stuck in this international adventure. That's usually how it's done. Well, and they did the same thing with Night and Day, if you remember that one with Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz back about 10 years ago. That's what this is going for. And it flips that, though. The international action star is Ana de Armas, and it's Chris Evans, who's the fish out of water, kind of the whiny, shrill, annoying girlfriend. They just flipped him. And I think that was actually kind of clever. And no one seems to pick up on that. Everyone just seems to be mad at the movie because it didn't have a theatrical release. But, you know, I got to say, for your action-oriented rom-com, it's totally fine. I mean, it's not brilliant, but it's honestly still fun with some refreshing swap of typical action gender roles. My wife would watch this. I think she'd get a big kick out of it. I've told her, I said, watch this. You'll enjoy it. I think you'll have a good time. So I'm going to buck tradition and say the heck with the rest of the critics. I'm going to say that Ghosted kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the movie Clock. Clock is on Hulu, and it's a horror film. A woman in her late 30s tries an experimental program to increase her desire to have children, and she faces horrifying consequences.
Ella, when are you and Aiden going to have kids?
Ella doesn't want kids.
Why don't you want kids?
Well,
you want kids.
The family is everything.
I have a family.
Don't worry, your clock will kick in.
There's a couple of empty chairs at the table.
Dad, can we not? I don't want children. I never have. I actually don't have a clock.
All women have a biological clock. Maybe yours is just broken.
A new biotech firm doing a clinical trial this month. I can get you in.
I am a big horror movie fan, and I also love sort of subgenres. And one subgenre I like is people in a lab trying to do something good for humanity and having it go horribly awry. But sort of a subgroup of that is horror movies about like people at a research facility that don't go quite well. You know, something like The Brood falls into that category. I find that intriguing. But I love the idea of somebody sort of trapped in a facility. You know, maybe it's a fear of medicine. Who knows? But that's essentially what this is. And it's this woman who just doesn't want kids, who doesn't feel her biological clock ticking in. But everyone's telling her, oh, that this is the point of it. And I think the big takeaway for this is a movie like Clock puts a spotlight on societal issues that not everybody shares the same opinion about. When it comes to introverts and extroverts, there's a real societal bias towards extroverts. They're like, oh, you should be involved in stuff. You should have a ton of friends. And if you don't, that's a warning sign. And I'm like, well, there's a lot of introverts out there who have either very few friends or limited friends, and they don't want to join a club or a sports or anything. That doesn't make them abnormal. That's just a different approach. And I feel the same way about the whole biological clock thing. Sure, there's a lot of women out there who are just very anxious to have kids. But then there are people who don't. And my personal belief is if you don't want to have kids, please don't have kids. Because if you don't want kids, having kids is not going to make you want them. And there is that push of people getting married and then being pushed to have kids. And I think that it hones in on that anxiety. Now, there's elements to this movie that are kind of absurd. Like she goes to this thing and they go, we're going to use an experimental hormonal compound on you and it'll be fine. And I'm like, meh. I'd be really careful allowing somebody to inject hormones into me that have been untested because you're in an experiment. And then also, she's like, oh, if you have any issues, let us know. And she starts hallucinating, and she doesn't tell anybody. And I'm like, well, so there's these dumb horror movie mistakes that people made, but it propels the story. And I mean, it does focus almost, you know, so exclusively on that. It's not very subtle about the societal implications and the society's pressure. But I think that this is a worthwhile thing, especially if there are women out there who are in their 30s who don't want kids, get behind this because it shows what some of the pressures are and puts it in that horror movie context. So, you know, although it's replete with silly horror movie choices, Clock manages to encapsulate the society-induced anxiety for a family. I'm going to say that Clock kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, and the Black Demon. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about the one that's in the theaters. It's not going to be huge. It's not going to topple Super Mario Brothers. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. But Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. A preteen girl in the 1970s struggles with life changes from the onset of puberty to moving to the suburbs to choosing a religion.
I'm here to speak to you today about your changing body.
Please, just do this one thing for me.
Let me just be normal and regular like everybody else. Just please, 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 please.
What I feel, I can't say.
I've decided I want you to join my secret club.
If you want to be in the club, then you have to wear a bra.
Oh. You think you need one?
All right, a little bit of insight into my life. I grew up in the 70s, and I grew up with a sister who was 2 years older than me. And now, while I grew up a boy, I saw through my sister what things were like as a girl. But this book was published in, I think, 1971, and it was all the rage in grade school. And it was notorious because it was hugely taboo. This is one of the most challenged books in American history, partly for the religious aspect, because the story is her mom's raised Christian, her father's raised Jewish, and they caught a lot of flack when they got married, and they didn't want to force her into a religion, so they kind of were letting her choose. And so there's a lot of confusion, and so she sort of just, the character Margaret, prays to just God, whoever, and she hasn't chosen which lens to look through. But it was also hugely controversial for its frank discussions of female sexuality and female development. Stuff that are very taboo, that you don't talk about in polite society, but all girls go through, all women go through this. And Judy Blume didn't let it get adapted for years because she didn't think it would get the right treatment. And I think it's getting the right treatment because there's a lot of reality to this. And the reality is told from that 11-year-old's perspective. And the reason that becomes entertaining is women have gone through this. Now, they went through it years ago, but it's a rite of passage. And in this movie, you see some of the most absurd, at times silly and comical things happen. And the characters that are happening to are completely wrapped up in it, so it's not funny to them. And that's the essence of the comedy of it. But I mean, like, there's a whole scene in there where the girls are doing exercises to try and increase their bust line. And they're like, I must increase. I remember that. And when that showed up in the book, there are all these girls in elementary school that would try to do that because they figured it would give them a larger chest. And you watch it now and you think this is insane. But that was certainly a thing that was going on in the 70s. And adult women were doing it too. So this movie really encapsulates the anxiety and the pressures and the worry and, the interpersonal relationships of girls in their transitional years. So as a boy, there was another book called Then Again, Maybe I Won't that was a little more geared towards boys. And a lot of the boys, especially at my age, when it was a little younger, we read Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing and then Super Fudge. And I was a little nervous seeing this movie because, well, first of all, I was, just this guy alone in a theater filled with women who are like, who's this weirdo? But I was laughing. I mean, it's very heartfelt. It's sweet. It has some great moments to it. It's directed by the woman who did Edge of 17, which was a fantastic deconstruction of teenage girls. And this is that deconstruction of preteen girls, girls that are just on the verge and starting to change. And it's just done exceptionally well. And then the other thing is the book was geared towards the kids. I mean, it was aimed to that target market. This movie actually expands it a bit because you got Rachel McAdams playing the mom and you've got Kathy Bates playing the grandmother. And they make it more accessible to the adults in the audience. So, like, mothers can take their daughters and both will get something different out of it, but it will be relatable to both. It's just an exceptionally well-done film. Is it going to win an Oscar? No. It's going to blip and do well, but this is a great example of, you get these movies every now and then that are just really exceptionally made, true movies that aren't meant to be this big, overstretching thing that's going to last and live forever, but it's just an effectively made film and it's important to see. And the people who don't want to talk about the content that's in this movie, those who would ban the book, you don't know what you're talking about. There's nothing crass or vulgar or blasphemous about this. It's a frank look at the world from the eyes of an 11-year-old girl, and there's a truth there. So I was very surprised at how much I really enjoyed this one. It's heartfelt and it's sweet. The movie captures the truth of childhood and development delivered excellently by Judy Blume. I'm going to say, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. Totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on and talk about The Black Demon. This is on, I think it's in some theaters, limited theaters. It's also on demand. A man brings his family on a business trip to a small coastal Mexican town, only to face a colossal shark.
I'm here to do the inspection.
What is it?
Protección. Protection from what?
Mom?
What's going on here?
What is that?
What's that look?
The Black Demon.
There must be some way off this rig.
Nothing works.
I don't think it can take much more punishment. This is not just any shark. It's a curse. Brought on not by nature, but by wrath.
This stars Josh Lucas as the father. That's the only really recognizable face or name you're going to see associated with this movie. And he works for an oil company, and there's this oil rig, offshore oil rig, at this Mexican town. And he's a safety inspector. So he's in there for, like, what, the annual inspection, and he's bringing his family with him, and he's his wife's from Mexico, and his kids, so of course they're mixed, and they were raised, they can speak Spanish, and they go to this town, and the town's kind of run down because it's not doing well economically, and when they go out to the rig, they discover there's this megalodon. You know, and a megalodon is, if you don't know what that is, the megalodon is, you've got great white sharks, which can grow to be 15 feet or so. The megalodon's like 80 feet. It's just basically like a massive great white shark. Supposedly is extinct, but there's no way to tell because you can't see the rest of the ocean, and it would probably be in the deepest part of the ocean, so it wouldn't spend much time at the surface. The movie's pretty rote. I mean, it's low budget in the sense that, I mean, it has some effects to it that are kind of impressive for what it's, I'm assuming its budget is. It's a smaller movie. The shark effects, and here's, I think, part of it is, I don't think this learned anything from Jaws. I mean, you want to talk the ultimate shark movie is Jaws, and you don't actually see Jaws, the shark, until well halfway into the movie. And it's still one of the most effective shark movies out there. And now they'll make movies, and they'll show sharks, and because you can do whatever you want to with CGI, but this one has a CGI shark to it, but of course it's a massive shark, so it all is going to be CGI. But Jaws was brilliant at telling the story without showing the shark, and there are some scenes in Jaws that are terrifying, and you don't see a lick of the shark. This one, they show the shark, but it's always underwater, and it's wide shots, and those are effective, but those should be the money shots, and the rest of it should be the dread that builds, and they don't quite balance that. I mean, then again, it's not directed by Spielberg, so you are tilting windmills with this one. I didn't love this, I'll be honest. I mean, it's ambitious and it has its moments, but it wrestles with its own limitations. I mean, it's certainly got some budgetary and effects limitations for how ambitious it is. And all I'm saying is that Jaws provides a blueprint of how to get around that. Plus, there are some logical inconsistencies. I really can't go into it because you'd have to know kind of how it ends. So it's imperfect, but look, if you're just looking for a killer shark movie and it's on demand, you could do worse. But still, it does have those limitations, and I'm going to have to say The Black Demon kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Peter Pan and Wendy and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and wrap things up with Peter Pan and Wendy. This is available on Disney Plus, not in theaters, it's on Disney Plus. The latest live-action adaptation of an animated Disney classic follows Wendy Darling as she and her brothers travel to Neverland to fight pirates.
Is that
Neverland? Is this everything you dreamed of?
I could never have dreamed of this!
What is this place?
No rules, no schools, no bedtimes, and most of all,
no growing up.
Are you Wendy?
Tiger Lily.
Peter.
Peter! Peter!
Captain, it's Peter Pan.
Never say
his name.
Disney is remaking live action versions or live action CGI versions, photorealistic versions of all of their classics. Are they going to do one for Saludos Amigos? Probably not. But they did Cinderella, they did Aladdin, and some are big box office successes, you know, stuff like Aladdin or The Lion King or Beauty and the Beast. And some have been kind of flops, like Dumbo was kind of a flop. They did a version of Pete's Dragon, which itself wasn't fully animated. It just the dragon was animated. So I would call that almost more of a remake. And instead of doing cell animation for the dragon, they just had CGI. And the guy who directed that, David Lowry, is directing this movie as well. Now, Pete's Dragon was a very different type of film than its original counterpart. So this is an updated version. It's on Disney Plus, which I think is was a wise choice for Disney not to put it in theaters. I don't know if it would have done particularly well in theaters just because the Peter Pan story, actually, if you look at it traditionally, the Peter Pan story doesn't do great in theaters. I mean, when they had that movie Pan that Joe Wright did a couple years ago, that one was not a huge success, although I thought that did a pretty decent job. As an adaptation of the Peter Pan story, it's relatively true to the original story. I mean, you've got Peter Pan, you've got Wendy, you've got all the kids. They follow a lot of the same beats where they go to Neverland. I mean, the original animation takes it on a much different path than what's in the original book. As I understand, I've never read the book, but as I understand the book, it's just sort of the series of scrapes that they get into. So they kind of give this more of a through line plot, but the plot's very similar to the original animated film. But there are some key differences. I'm mixed with the cinematography because I think the cinematography gives that murky look, which is very typical of David Lowry's stuff. But that's overly trendy and it looks murky and it doesn't look as vibrant and colorful. And you really, with Neverland, you could really go vibrant and colorful, and they don't. But at least you can see people's faces. Even if they're backlit, they do throw a light on their face, which good. We finally got to the point where we're going to light the actors in a scene. The other problem is most Peter Pan adaptations nowadays are made by filmmakers who grew up with Peter Pan. And that makes it different because the original Peter Pan, the animated film from the 50s, it's very much a kid's movie. It's told from a kid's perspective. A lot of these other movies, you know, even stuff like Hook, obviously, but things like this film are told from an adult perspective, giving a regret on growing up. Everybody grows up with regrets and unfulfilled dreams. And those get addressed in almost every Peter Pan adaptation, even though that's not addressed in the original source material, really. I mean, even then, James Berry put a tag on at the end of the book and the play that deals with it very peripherally, but still makes Peter Pan, there's no regrets to his character, where in most versions of it, there is. And with that updating it, you also run into some other problems. Now, they make this more Wendy's story because Wendy, very much like Margaret, is on the cusp of becoming a woman. So she's kind of old to be going to Neverland, but she's still a kid and she still embraces that, but that's what draws her back. But there's also some things in the original version of Peter Pan that are kind of cringeworthy. I mean, you can't authentically portray Tiger Lily from the play or the books without being horribly racist. I mean, Tiger Lily is a very problematic character because it's done in a very demonstrative way. I mean, it shows the natives as crazy savages and, you know, almost caricatures, certainly in the Disney animated version. So they kind of swing too far into the, I mean, in this one, she's just riding around on a horse and she's, I don't know, there's nothing to the character. I would just leave her out because she doesn't really do anything. Because in the original Peter Pan, she exists for Peter to save. Peter's got his own group of women or girls who like him. Everyone from Tiger Lily to Tinkerbell to Wendy. He's kind of a player as a child. That gets in the way a little bit, but I think the bigger obstacles come from the adult looking back making the movie and the regrets that somebody like Captain Hook, played by Jude Law, who does a good job, but really it's kind of at times aches to be his movie, but it's not. So there are some problems with it, but it still has that wonder. I mean, it's still packed with that wonder of the original, but it does struggle against the modern necessities of an update of this story. Still, I'm going to say Peter Pan and Wendy. It's perfectly fine to watch on Disney Plus with the kids on the weekend. I'll say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Recently, I have been getting into Star Trek again. I come and go with Star Trek. I was really into it in college, and then I kind of drifted away. I couldn't keep up with the syndicated series. But I recently rewatched the entire original series, which there are episodes I realized I'd never seen just because I never ended up catching them when they were on television. But I'm also going back and watching the original films. I watched Star Trek The Motion Picture, talked about it a couple months ago on this program. But I also went back recently and rewatched Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. And I thought this is a great one to revisit because there's a lot to mine in that Star Trek canon. So in this second outing for the crew of the Enterprise on the big screen, Khan has returned to take revenge on Captain James T. Kirk.
Chase him round the moons of Nibia and round the Antares maelstrom and round perdition's flames before I give him up. There she is. There she is. I need warp speed in 3 minutes or we're all dead.
Now, I remember seeing this movie in 1982 in the theaters, and I had actually never seen The Space Seed, which was with the original episode that this is spun off of. So I was a little confused. I've since seen The Space Seed a couple times, and what's interesting is you don't need to see The Space Seed to understand The Wrath of Khan. You just have to get what's in the backstory. But I'll tell you, this is an incredibly efficient movie. It's a banger from beginning to end. It is extremely well directed and written because it takes the characters from the Enterprise and makes them slightly older versions, you know, 15 years older than they were in the original series. It does a much better job at handling the characters than the motion picture. Even though I like that first movie in retrospect and as an adult, this one is very much in tune with the characterization of them. But it also is quintessentially Star Trek. And it's funny because I think they had to trim down the budget because the first movie was so expensive. They like recycle some footage for this one and they don't get as ambitious with some of the things, but they still have the battles in space and they have the Enterprise footage. But ultimately, it's a story of revenge. And you know, the Star Trek canon constantly references Moby Dick. And that's kind of what this is going for, because Kirk is Khan's white whale. And to the point that he wants to go after his own destruction to seek that revenge. The other thing is, I remember there was a line that I think was Justin Lin said about making Star Trek Beyond. And he's like, well, you know, when I watched the show, it was always the people who had the bigger ship that wins. And I'm like, that's not true. In fact, sort of the point of Wrath of Khan is it shows the brains over brawn. It shows intellectualism will beat raw anger and testosterone any day. If you're smarter than your opponent, that's better than being stronger than your opponent. Because then you can take advantage, and especially if you've got somebody who is so focused on one thing, you can utilize that. There's so much to learn from this. It's an efficient movie. It's got laughs. It's got tears. It really is a fantastic film. This is electrifying and efficient. The Star Trek Tales strikes a perfect balance of action and nostalgia, because it ties back to the original series so well, and brains over brawn. This is seriously still one of the best Star Trek movies ever made, if not the best Star Trek movie ever made. Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
And that's it. I need to go. Next week I'm going to be talking about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.